Well, as we began our series in Hosea last week, last Sunday morning, we saw how the prophet was called to take up a very difficult task, an unusual task compared to all of the other prophets, but a task that was given to him by God, no less. God had instructed him to marry a woman who was a known prostitute who had been previously immoral in her sexual behaviour and would likely be faithless to her husband. Not only was Hosea commanded to marry this woman, and I do believe he was actually commanded to marry a real woman. This wasn't a picture, this wasn't a metaphor. This is a real woman, Gomer, the daughter of Diblaim. That detail is given to us for that purpose, to show us that she is a real woman living at the time of Hosea. And not only was he to marry her, he was to have children with her. One of them, we noticed, seems likely to be his biological child, while the other two may very well have been children that have come as a result of her unfaithfulness. But both his marriage and the names of his children, or there were three, Jezreel, No Mercy, and Not My People, would all be prophetic pictures to the people in the northern kingdom of Israel, which would remind them of their fractured relationship with God. The relationship was fractured not because God had been unfaithful, not because God had been impatient, not because God had done anything wrong, but because his people had been unfaithful. They had been spiritually adulterous. And so the chapter 2 begins with God making a legal case against his children, against the people of Israel, for a divorce. The God who hates divorce, in this chapter, is warning of divorce for his people's unfaithfulness. He says that Israel has committed spiritual adultery by taking the gods of the surrounding nations for their own and worshipping them by making sacrifices and offerings to them. And unless they turn from their unfaithfulness, unless they turn from their unfaithful ways, the ESV pulls no punches in the way it has translated their actions, to turn away from their whoring, they will find that they will not be his bride and he will not be their husband. And yet, though verses 2 through 5 are a legal case of what will happen if they do not put their adultery away, if they do not stop going after their lovers, the idols of the surrounding nations, the rest of the chapter shows us how God is not done with his people, how God is going to pursue them, even though they have been unfaithful to him. And as we look at Hosea chapter 2 this morning, we're going to see how not only how God pursued them in their day, but how God pursues his people today, even when we ourselves are guilty of committing spiritual adultery by giving ourselves to other things as though they are God in place of the true God who has rescued us, sending his son into the world to save us through his blood shed on the cross. And so I want you really this morning to see two ways in which God pursues his adulterous people. And here's the first way. I want you to see how God pursues us with shocking severity. shocking severity in verses 6 to 13. I mean, after all, I don't think there's another word to describe it, or another two words to describe God's actions, which he promises from verses 6 to 13. I don't know if you took the opportunity to read this chapter when beforehand, or if you were reading it for the first time when I was publicly reading it, but there is some very vivid and very shocking language here, isn't there? He speaks of stripping her naked. He speaks of bringing walls against her. He speaks of even killing her with thirst. But all of this, as we look at the shocking language, and as we consider the severity that God speaks of about what he is going to do with his people, all of this is a pursual. All of this is actually for their good. And I want you to see three areas where they have persistently been unfaithful to him, but how God is going to pursue them in all of those areas. So firstly, notice that he pursues them in their apostasy. Apostasy is when we go away from God. We leave our first love. Now, when God had called his people to follow him all the way back in Exodus, when he had rescued them out of slavery to Pharaoh and brought them to Mount Sinai, and where he made covenant with them, he promised to be their God if they would be his people. And as long as they walked with him, he would be with them. He would be their God. And how would they walk with him? By keeping all of the commandments that he has given. And this wasn't a coercive relationship. This wasn't a relationship they had been forced into, because after all, they had said there at Mount Sinai, "We will do these things. We will keep your law. We will be your people." They had agreed, they had entered covenant with him. But very quickly Israel became like a promiscuous woman slipping out of in the cover of darkness, hoping that her husband will not notice what she's up to. So quickly they wandered away from God. They were expert at wandering in the wilderness, but that was only to demonstrate that they were expert at wandering away from the God who had saved them. They longed in the wilderness for the food that they had apparently enjoyed. Of all things, they enjoyed the cucumbers that were grown in Egypt. Never mind the slavery that they were in and the fact that Pharaoh was throwing their children in the river. They missed the cucumbers. Oh, they were expert at wandering away from the God who had loved them, who had led them. Disobeying his law, breaking it. You remember how they hadn't even left Sinai, and they had made a golden image for themselves that they called God. And until Moses came down from the mountain and found this great act of corporate immorality happening, and he threw the tablets of the commandments down, smashing them. And yet in their wandering, God says, "I'm going to pursue you in your wandering. And I'm going to do this by building a hedge of thorns around you. Every time you seek to go away, you'll find it difficulty. You'll find problems. Your way will become hard. You won't be able to find your paths that wander from me." And he pursues them also in their idolatry. Verse 7, "She shall pursue her lovers, but not overtake them. And she shall seek them, but shall not find them. Then she shall say, 'I will go and return to my first husband, for it was better for me than for now.' And she did not know. It was I who gave her the grain, the wine, and the oil, and who lavished on her silver and gold, which they used for Baal. Therefore I will take back my grain in its time and my wine in its season, and I will take away my wool and my flax, which were to cover her nakedness. See, in the Old Testament, idolatry isn't merely worshipping something in place of the Lord. We often define idolatry as something having first place in our hearts rather than God, something other than God having first place in our hearts. But the Old Testament's definition is actually much more than that. Because idolatry in the Old Testament is the action of worshipping something that is not God in the hope of that thing giving you some material advantage, gain, or blessing. So they will take the crops that they had been given by God Himself, who provides for all that we have, and they would bring it and they would sacrifice it to Baal. And why would they bring it to Baal? Why would they enter this pagan ritual? In the hope that Baal would give them better crops next year. This wasn't only exclusive to the crops, such as wool and grain and wine and oil. This was even in fertility practices, where they would enter in relationships with cultic prostitutes, reenacting certain rituals in the hope of Baal bringing them fertility, bringing crops to their land. You see, that's what idolatry is. Taking something that is not God and pursuing it in the hope that that thing will bring you the blessings that you really want. So, for example, how does this happen today? Well, the person who is discontent in their relationship, wanting intimacy, crosses the bounds of God, of what God has given, and turns to something like pornography, hoping that that will give them the craving, the pleasure, the intimacy that they desire. Or the person who is anxious about their own spiritual salvation, rather than trusting in God and His promises, they turn to religious traditions that give them comfort for their assurance. As long as I am doing this and not departing from that, as long as I am going in the same way as which I did as a child in my religious traditions, then I shall be fine. Because it gives me a sense of assurance. And any time that tradition is taken away, that assurance isn't given to me, and therefore I become impatient and quite irritable. We should trust the Lord for our salvation. Or the person who is concerned about their future and hopes for material comfort and prosperity, rather than trusting the Lord who says, I will provide for you every day everything you need, rather than praying, Our Father in heaven, hallowed be your name, your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven, give us this day our daily bread. We begin trusting our career, our job security, and career is not a bad thing, is it? Job security is not a bad thing, but when it becomes the all-encompassing thing, because if we're not putting everything, all of ourselves into it, then we become anxious. We don't know what to do with ourselves. Our future is in danger. We do idolatry all the time, just not in the same way as the ancient Near East. Treating something as God, as though it can do what God alone can do for us. Giving us security, giving us provision, offering us salvation. And God says, I'm pursuing you in this because I'm going to take away your idols. You will look for them, but you won't find them. I'll frustrate your pursuit of them. And the blessings that you think they give to you, well, you've forgotten that I'm the God who gives you those blessings, and I alone give you those blessings. I'm going to take them from you. I'll strip you of those blessings. So they become like the prodigal son who left his father, and he goes to a far off distant country, taking his inheritance with him. He spends all that he's got in wild living, and he ends up in the pig pen, envious that the pigs are eating while he is not eating. And he says to himself, it was better being in my father's house. Not only does he pursue them in their apostasy and their idolatry, he pursues them in their hypocrisy. Verses 10 to 13, now I will uncover her lewdness in the sight of her lovers. No one shall rescue her out of my hand. And I'll put an end to all her mirth, her feasts, her new moons, her Sabbaths, and all her appointed feasts. And I will lay waste her vines and her fig trees, of which she said, these are my wages, which my lovers have given me. I will make them a forest, and the beast of the field shall devour them. And I will punish her for the feast days of the Baals, when she burned offerings to them and adorned herself with her ring and jewellery, and went after her lovers and forgot me, declares the Lord. You see, the Lord paints them here as those who on the outward look to, like beautiful and as though they're doing well. She's adorned herself with rings and jewellery. And this time when Hosea was prophesying was one of the most prosperous times in Israel's history. And if you looked at their religious life, well, they look like they're playing the part of good religious Jews. They're actually keeping the feast that God had given them in the law. They're keeping the new moons, the Sabbaths, the appointed feasts. Outwardly, they look like they're doing well. Materially prosperous, religiously obedient. But God says inwardly, you're using these feasts to give praise to Baal. You're dressing yourself up to impress your gods, your lovers. You care more for them than you do for me. You've forgotten me. And so God says, I'm going to pursue you in this way. I'm going to take away your feasts. I'm going to take away your joy. I'm going to take away all of the things that you boast in, your vines and your fig trees. I'll lay bare your hypocrisy. The armies would march in, and that's exactly what they did. They'd take the people into exile, no more feasts, no more Sabbaths. Their vines and fig trees and their fields and their farming would all be ravaged. Unless Israel put away their shameless idolatry, God says he will publicly shame them for their adultery. When we go, well, that's Israel. Well, don't we see ourselves in Israel? We act like Israel when we turn from God to find blessings from other places, from other things. We carry on our religious pretense while our hearts are far from him. Well, don't be surprised when those things that you are seeking in other places, from other sources, don't bring the fulfillment that they promised at the start. Because God pursues us with shocking severity. If we're wandering from him in our hearts, he may very well frustrate our ways and take away those things that we are seeking. that we might turn back to him. That we might say with Israel, I will go and return to my first husband, for it was better for me then than now. God is a jealous God. And he will pursue his bride with shocking severity. But I want you to remember, this is actually a good thing. Why is it a good thing? Well, you may want to come with me to Hebrews chapter 12. In Hebrews chapter 12 and verse 6, we read this. For the Lord disciplines the one he loves and chastises every son whom he receives. God pursues his people with shocking severity because he loves his bride. But then there's a second way in which God pursues us. I want you to see how God pursues us with surprising mercy in verses 14 to 23. And here the tone of the chapter changes. God has been speaking severely, but now he says he's going to speak tenderly. And he gives us two great promises. Firstly, he promises reconciliation. Look at verses 14 to 15. Therefore, behold, I will allure her and bring her into the wilderness and speak tenderly to her. And there I will give her her vineyards and make the valley of Achor a door of hope. And there she shall answer as in the days of her youth. Or you can translate it in this way. There she shall sing as in the days of her youth, as at the time when she came out of the land of Egypt. And in that day, declares the Lord, you will call me my husband and will no longer call me my Baal. For I will remove the names of the Baals from her mouth, and they shall be remembered by name no more. And I will make for them a covenant on that day. And then come down to verse 19. I will betroth you to me forever. I will betroth you to me in righteousness and in justice, in steadfast love and in mercy. I'll betroth you to me in faithfulness. And you shall know the Lord. And then come down again to verse 23. He says, I will have mercy on no mercy. And I will say to not my people, you are my people. And he shall say, you are my God. God promises here reconciliation between him and his bride. There will be a time when God, after the exile, will bring his bride back to where their marriage began. I'll bring you into the wilderness. We'll go back to the first days. And there I'm going to speak tenderly to you. And where is that place that he speaks of? He says, the Valley of Achor. What is the Valley of Achor? The Valley of Achor was where one of the most egregious and infamous sins of Israel was committed by Achan. When he stole the devoted things and he hid them away from the Lord, and a judgment came on the camp, and then until they found the culprit, who was Achan. And there in the Valley of Achor, Achan was cut off from the covenant and from the nation. He was stoned to death along with his family for his sin. The Valley of Achor was a reminder of the severity of God. But the Valley of Achor now, in that day, says the Lord, is going to be a door of hope, of restored relationship, where my people will be mine once again. They will call me my husband, and no longer will the Baals, their former lovers, be in their mouths. And I will have mercy on them, and they will be my people, and I will be their God. I will do this. I will betroth myself to them. There will not be a divorce. There'll be an engagement. In righteousness, in steadfast love, in faithfulness, in mercy. But he also promises redemption. From verse 18, and I will make for them a covenant on that day with the beasts of the field, the birds of the heavens, and the creeping things of the ground. And I will abolish the bow, the sword, and war from the land, and I will make you lie down in safety. And I'll betroth you to me forever. See, the language here is of new creation. I'm going to make a covenant, says God. But not with the people. I'm going to make a covenant with the beasts, the birds, and the creeping things. This is all creation language. Because God is saying, I'm going to not only reconcile you to myself, but I'm going to redeem the land that you have corrupted by your sin. I'm going to bring restored relationship and a restored land for you to live in. Look what he says in verse 21. In that day I will answer, declares the Lord. Presumably I will answer your prayers. Your prayers for blessing. I will answer the heavens, and they shall answer the earth. How will they answer the earth? With rain. And the earth shall answer the grain, because as the heavens answer, the earth answers by bringing forward vegetation. Shall answer with the grain, the wine, and the oil, and they shall answer Jezreel. Jezreel here is most likely being used for Israel. And he says, I'm going to, in that place, make you lie down in safety. A restored people in a restored place where God is at the center. And we may look and we actually see this promise in the New Testament going further, don't we? Because it's not just with his a reconciliation with those who were descended physically from Abraham, but those who are descended spiritually from Abraham, exercising faith in the Lord Jesus Christ. And not just a physical land with borders and boundaries, but a restoration of the whole world. Peter writes in his first letter to the churches, speaking to the Christians, reading his letter, in 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 10, once you were not a people, but now you are God's people. Once you had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy. We were Israel in the sense that we were not we were unworthy of receiving God's mercy. We were separated from Christ, from covenant. But now God has had mercy on us. God has had mercy, and we who were once called no mercy are now called have now received mercy, and those of us who were once not his people have now been called his people. And we have a wonderful hope to look forward to. A wonderful time when the Lord will restore not merely a land with borders, but with the whole world. We read in Revelation 21, verses 1 to 3, very familiar words. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more. Then I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a what? A bride, adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, behold, the dwelling place of God is with man. He will dwell with them, and they will be his people, and God himself will be with them as their God. If you are guilty of spiritual adultery today, as Israel were then, will you listen to God, who is the God who pursues with severity, but with mercy? Where do we see this most clearly? Surely we see this most clearly at the cross of Jesus Christ. who came in order to die in the place of his people, bearing their sin, receiving wrath and judgment from God, so that we might be rescued, restored, reconciled to the God we have offended. So stop wandering away from God. Put your idolatry away and turn from any and all hypocrisy and find mercy through faith in God's Son who loves you and gave himself for you.